There were several songs about Zion this morning, and it kind of works out, I guess. The Bible could be called a lot of things and bear a lot of titles, and I suppose one of those titles could be A Tale of Two Cities, because the first city that was established by man, and the last city is one that is built by God. And really, the Bible kind of traces the history of those two cities, one that is going to have an end and one that will not. And the difference between those two is an interesting contrast. I'd like to begin by going back to the book of Genesis and picking up a couple pieces of information there that I think are quite striking. We know about the creation with Adam and Eve, and then they, of course, after their fall, gave birth to Cain and Abel. We're familiar with the story of Cain and Abel, how Cain's sacrifice was not as righteous as Abel's because it was not offered in faith, according to the New Testament, probably because he did not offer what God had asked him to. And so Cain hated his brother and he slew him. And God did something interesting at this point, at least from my perspective, is that his punishment of Cain was not capital. He did not take Cain's life from him. Instead, he set a mark on Cain that he should be a vagabond and a wanderer on the earth without a place. Adam and Eve, while they were moved from the Garden of Eden to a place east of Eden, it looks like they lived a somewhat settled existence, and that may be the way that God intended it. However, the establishment of a city was Cain's alone. And we remember the reason that he did that. This mark that God gave him was identification to let others know that Cain was protected by the Lord. God said, yes, your punishment is to walk as a vagabond on the earth. However, I'm going to set this mark on you, and everyone's going to know that they're not supposed to strike you and harm you. They're going to know that you are wandering under my protection. And that was his punishment. But that wasn't good enough for Cain. He went further east, I guess, from where his parents had been taken from Eden. And he established for himself a city. And he named it for his first son. The first city was called Enoch. And it represented, if nothing else, Cain's ability to protect himself regardless of the Lord's promises. And many of man's rebellions are against God are of this same kind of nature, this desire to do something apart from God, to attempt to do something better than God, or simply for the reason that we can't fully trust God for whatever personal reason. So this first city of man called Enoch represents rebellion, a rejection of God's promises, and the desire to secure our own future apart from God. And of course, you and I believe that this is impossible. And the Bible presents these two stark contrasts. The first city was made by men's hands. It was made by man to suit man. And it was made by man to protect himself from other men. The last city spoken of in Revelation 21 is a city not made by hands, whose builder and maker is God. It is made to suit God. And it is made to glorify God. Three completely different things. And it's interesting also to consider Genesis and Revelation. In the Bible, God's ideal was to place man in a garden. But eventually, within a few chapters, man rebels and will ultimately build himself a city because he can't trust God. And yet God turns this institution around, this idea of a city, and turns it on its head. And it's going to be realized in eternity. And it was Jesus himself in the Gospels who said, I will make you as a city set on a hill. And a city set on a hill cannot be hidden. So the Bible, in a sense, begins and ends with a city. And the Bible may be seen as a narrative of the enmity between those two cities. And the quite disparate destinies of the city of Cain on one hand and the city of God on the other. What I'd like to do is consider the ultimate city of Cain, which is read about in our reading in the book of Daniel. And I want you to keep that story of Nebuchadnezzar in mind as we begin to close. And hopefully I'll remember to do that as well. But Babylon is sort of the ultimate city of Cain. It's the perfect, idealized, carnal city in the Bible. When you read the New Testament and you read several references to Babylon in the New Testament, almost all of those that I can think of are actually a reference to Rome. It was like a code word for Rome. If you were a Jew in the first century AD, Rome was the reality of your life. And it weighed upon you, impressed upon you, that here were these pagans walking around with their idol statues of eagles and whatnot on their legions, and they marched into your holy city and even into your temple precincts whenever they wanted, for whatever reason. And that grated on you. Because God was not supposed to have any images in the city. They were supposed to be an independent nation with God as their king. They knew that they had messed all of that up. So Babylon or Rome was the reality. And when they talked about Rome, they talked in code language in essence. And that's really what the book of Revelation bears out as well. The references to Babylon are often references to Rome. Even Peter, when he wrote his letter, said, "The lady in Babylon greets you." And almost everyone universally agrees that he was actually writing from the city of Rome when he called it Babylon. But it wasn't just the Jew, and we can understand the reason for that. Babylon was the empire of the captivity. And that was the second great reality of the Jews if you were born in the first century AD, is that you were under the oppression of Rome and you had just come out of the oppression of the Babylonian Empire. And those two things had shaped your entire existence. And it wasn't just the Jews who idealized the Babylonian Empire. And I always found this kind of interesting when I would read a history book that had nothing to do with the Jews or whatever. But if you were a Hellenistic or Roman general or statesman in the last centuries of the BCs and the first centuries of the ADs, there was one guy that you would want to emulate. Who would that be? Can anybody guess? You might say Caesar, but Caesar himself wanted to emulate someone else. Alexander the Great. He was the guy. He was the superhero of his day. And when you look at his life and career, he started at the age of 21, conquered the Persian Empire actually within a few years, kept going east and conquered part of India. And by the age of 32, he had the world's largest empire. And he was younger, well younger than I am today now when he did that. So Alexander Great was the guy that you wanted to emulate. But when they talked about the empire they wanted to establish, the people of the first century AD tended to want to talk about Babylon. Babylon had this kind of mystical thing to it that the people of that day really admired. It was kind of like people today talking about, I don't know what they would talk about to compare to Babylon. I guess they would actually talk about Babylon still. It was kind of this ideal. Much like Alexander. So if you were a conqueror, you wanted to be Alexander, but the empire you wanted to establish was Babylon. And the Bible bears that out as well. We remember Nebuchadnezzar, when he had his dream, the head of gold was his empire. And all those others were inferior. And I always thought that was interesting, because Nebuchadnezzar's empire only lasted 70 years. And when you compare that to Assyria, which was the mega power for hundreds of years, and then Persia and Greece, and then Rome had an empire that lasted 1,500 years by some reckonings. And yet Babylon's was the empire of gold. It was the one that everyone aspired to. So you look at the history of the Greek Empire, and it's kind of a neat thing, and Rome is kind of inspiring. But Babylon had this curse and this aura about it. Babylon wasn't the first empire, perhaps, but it did set the standard. It was the ideal. It was the dream. It was the city itself, because there had never been anything like it. And it was only prominent for a short while. And the irony of Babylon as well is that when it was at its greatest, it was not under native rulership, which is kind of unique among the empires of the world. Historians will speak of two Babylonian empires. The first one was really old, covering a time period from about 2000 BC to about 1500 or 1400 BC. But its apex or its peak during that time was actually its last 150 years or so, when it was controlled by what is called the Kassite dynasty. And the Kassites were barbarians who, as Babylon started to get old and as empires start to get old, they tend to get decrepit and weak and things like that, just like people do. Well, barbarians come in and they've got all that vigor and all that stuff, and they go in then, they kind of revitalize the thing, and that's what the Kassites did for 150 years. And then Babylon fell to a younger power, Assyria. And even through the next, almost 500-600 years that Babylon was a second-rate city, it still maintained a mystique. And it's curious as to why that is. And then what's called the second or the Neo-Babylonian Empire was actually set up by what's called the Chaldean dynasty. And that includes Nebuchadnezzar. And the Chaldeans were related to the Arameans, who are Western Semitic. And they had once been nomadic tribesmen, and much like the Kassites, they came out of the desert, conquered Babylon, and took it over and made it great once again. But Babylon has a much, I think, much more interesting history than just that. Genesis chapter 10 is what's called, begins a series of the Old Testament. It's called the Table of Nations. And it mentions an interesting character once we get to Babylon. Starting in verse 8, Cush begot Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, and Calna in the land of Shinar. From that land he went to Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth-ir, Calah, and Resen, between Nineveh and Calah, that is the principal city. Just those three verses have excited a lot of speculation, and it does seem to, it kind of inspires me a little bit, start thinking. But we have this gentleman Nimrod, and it appears that he's the world's first great warrior king. Babel is one of the first cities that he conquers. And I said, some people say he built Babel, but I don't. I tend to break down the narrative of his story into two parts. It says that Nimrod, the beginning of his kingdom, was Babel, Erech, Akkad, and Calna in the land of Shinar. Most experts believe that Shinar is a different way to say Sumer. And so it was that the most southern part of Mesopotamia, meaning to what would eventually be called the Persian Gulf. I think he conquered those cities, and then he headed north and built the cities that it mentions him actually building, being Nineveh, Rehoboth-ir, and Calah. And this would have been a few generations after the flood. And he seems to have established what we might consider the first empire. And it even mentions something about him that's kind of interesting, is that it calls him a mighty hunter before the Lord. I've thought about that, and there's no way I'm going to say I'm right or wrong, but God has used powers and people and empires to punish others. And it could be that he was used in a similar fashion. But we do have this city called Babel. In chapter 11, we're given a little bit more detail when it talks about the Babel. Men had come from the east, it says, to the plain of Shinar, which is an ancient name for Babylonia. And archaeology seems to confirm, at least right now, that the oldest things that you might call a city are found in the mountainous places of Iran. And in fact, the world's oldest ziggurat that we know of is actually in Iran as well. And we'll talk about that ziggurat a little bit later. But people came from what we would consider Iran or Elam and came down and built the city Babel. Genesis 10:9 says, therefore, its name is called Babel because there the Lord confused the language of the earth, of all the earth. And here we have, by inspiration, a Hebrew pun, you might say, because the Hebrew word for confuse is B-A-L-A-L, Balal, which means to confuse. However, the name of the city in Hebrew is Bab-El, B-A-B-E-L. And its Akkadian name, which is an Eastern Semitic language, is Bab-il, B-A-B-I-L. And both of those words mean gate of God. Now, anytime you see E-L in your Bibles, for the most part, whether it's a place name or a personal name, that has a theophoric element, God. And so lots of pagans also had an EL or AL or IL element to it. So that in itself means very little, but one thing that struck me about this is that the world is famous, really, ancient history is famous for its pagan history and temples and things like that, but here we have this city, and it's the beginning of Nimrod's kingdom, and it's called the Gate of God. The Gate of God. And it may inform us a little bit as to the purpose of the tower that's going to be built in chapter 11, the Tower of Babel, the Tower of the Gate of God. Now, what's going to happen eventually is this city is going to have its name morph a little bit. And when we get to Babylon later on in the Old Testament, it's an English translation of a Greek name, which for most of its history it has gone by. Its name in Eastern Akkadian is Babilu, B-A-B-I-L-U, and it means Gate of Gods. So the city went from Gate of God to Gate of Gods. And we remember Nimrod began to be a mighty one on the earth. A lot of historians and Bible scholars think that Nimrod is probably an archetype for a lot of the warrior gods that begin to permeate in the Middle East around this time. And therefore, Babel or Babylon is often associated with the birth of paganism and the birth of god kings and priest kings and things like that. As the third millennium BC progressed, Sumerian cities took turns being the dominant city, and Babylon fell into somewhat obscurity, not to mention historically, until the time of Sargon the Great, who was an Akkadian. And you'll remember it mentioned that city, Akkad, in Genesis chapter 10. He was an Akkadian, and the Akkadians eventually rose up and conquered all of the Sumerian city-states, and Shinar becomes known as Sumer and Akkad. And the primary king of this region of the world would be known as the king of Sumer and Akkad for another 2,000 years, roughly. Also, keep in mind, up until the Persian Empire, after the fall of the third dynasty of Ur, which would have been around the time of Abraham, Babylon became a provincial center, and it became the nucleus of a small kingdom that eventually would grow. And by 1894 would be what you might call a baby empire. And it had several dynasties that would continue to grow Babylon and grow its power and prestige. It had a favorable location, and then it was in the middle of what we call Mesopotamia, which is a Greek word, the land between two rivers. And the reason that you see all this shifting of power between these cities in Mesopotamia is because it's a plain. Plains are really hard to defend, at least in ancient times they were, because you had the mountains on one side and tribesmen and barbarians could come down from the mountains whenever they wanted to and they could sweep through your cities. And on the west it had desert and more plains, and nomadic tribesmen riding their camels and horses could come in and it was hard to defend. So you had all this movement. But the people of that region, no matter what city or what king was in charge, always regarded Babylon as a model. They always looked to its religion, to its culture, its civilization, its structure of government and institutions, and emulated those things again and again. Until eventually, we get down to Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon 1,000 years later. Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon was the largest city in the world at that time, covering about 4 square miles, which doesn't seem like a whole lot by today's standard. But this 4 square miles was completely enclosed by walls. The Euphrates River, which had shifted its course since that time, at that point flowed actually through the city of Babylon, or the older part of the city, being on the east bank. There, the central feature was the great temple ziggurat of Marduk, with its associated ziggurat, which was a tower built in 7 stages. The ziggurat and the foundation and its foundation still exists today. It has a base of 300 feet on each side. And in its seven stages, the uppermost contained a temple built in blue glazed brick. It reached a total height that was equal to that of the base. So it was 300 feet tall, which makes it essentially the same size as the Pyramid of Giza in Egypt. So this was an extremely massive building. And what's been discovered is that the foundation of that temple is thousands of years older than the temple that was built there in the time of Nebuchadnezzar. And there's some speculation that that may actually be the foundation of the Tower of Babel. Because what the ancients tended to do was dig their foundations, and then no matter how many times the building was burnt down or fell down because of an earthquake, they tended to just rebuild on those foundations. That's somewhat speculation, but interesting to me all the same. There's a lot that could be said about Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon, but just some pieces of information to give us an idea. It contained a population of over 200,000, and it's estimated that there were so many bricks used in its construction that if you were to line the bricks up end to end, you could travel from the equator of the earth to the moon back and forth 2.5 times. Billions of bricks were used in the construction of the city of Babylon. So as Nebuchadnezzar is walking amongst the Hanging Gardens, which is one of the seven wonders of the ancient worlds that he also had built, and he's viewing this city with its 200,000 inhabitants, its billions of bricks perhaps used in its construction, all the wealth of the ancient world was flowing into it, it's little surprise that he might take a look at that and say, is this not Babylon that I have built for the might of my power and for my own majesty? And he was the inheritor of a grand tradition at that point. I'd like to just point out three things, and I'm going to choose the Greeks, the way the Greeks looked at Babylon, because for a long time the Greeks were barbarians themselves and were ignorant of a lot of things. And as they started becoming more and more enlightened, I guess, it's kind of interesting to think of, to look at Babylon the way they did. This is what the Greeks knew of Babylon, or at least what they perceived Babylon as. From the 19th century BC on, Babylonia was the most educated city and region in Mesopotamia, with achievements in literature, astronomy, mathematics, and medicine that were only matched 100 years later or so by ancient Egypt. In fact, the Babylonians developed the Pythagorean theorem 1,000 years before Pythagoras himself. They were also the builders of the first true public schools. Their religion became the default religion for all of Mesopotamia and was considered the holiest city of that part of the world. They gave the world astrology and the zodiac, including horoscopy, which you can still flip open your paper and read your horoscope today. They were regarded by the Greeks as the original users of magic and have ever been regarded as a mystical empire even to this day. They were one of the first civilizations with a codified law system. Codified laws, and a system of courts. And this code influenced every other Mesopotamian empire and even influenced the Roman Empire. So these are just a handful of the achievements of the Babylonians. So when Nebuchadnezzar's looking at this city and he's the inheritor of all this great culture, he gets a little prideful. And the sins of Nebuchadnezzar kind of echo what we think of when we think of mankind in general. In this last section, with the last few minutes, I'd like to consider just a few things. If you look at the Bible as God versus Babylon, or God versus the cities and achievements of men, for all its achievements, might, and splendor, Babylon could not forever withstand God. Now, there were a lot of sins of Babylon, but you can boil them down to one: pride. We see that with Nebuchadnezzar here. But that's also made mention of in Jeremiah chapter 50, verses 31 through 51, verse 2. Daniel chapter 4, verse 30, which we just read. Isaiah chapter 13, verse 19. All speak of the pride of the Chaldeans and Babylon. So pride was one of their sins. The other one was that they were oppressors. Also in Jeremiah 50, 33 through 34. All the riches of the known world were sucked in by Babylon in order to build it. Also idolatry. Again, Jeremiah 50 and 51. Revelations chapter 17, verse 2. Genesis chapter 11. When you get to Revelation, Babylon is called the mother of harlots. It could be very well that Babel was the birthplace of paganism and idolatry, because it was the home of the first quote-unquote God kings that we know of historically. And what was the end of Babylon? Babylon continued to be the cultural administrative center of the Persian Empire, but Babylonians still thought of themselves as the masters of the world, and they rebelled multiple times against Persia, and they met no success. The city had to be retaken several times by the Persian, and each time they took it, it resulted in more extensive damage to the city. Eventually, Persia got sick of it, and they ransacked the entire city, took its idols away, which were a symbol of its independence, and were part of what gave it its prestige, and they literally taxed it to death after that. They taxed it so heavily that the city could no longer maintain its grand buildings and its walls, and it literally began to disintegrate. So that by the time, just a couple hundred years later, in 331 BC, Alexander the Great took the city and found it in major need of renovation. And he was in the process of beginning that when he actually died at the age of 32 or 3, I believe. He may have been 33, somewhere around there. And he never got to complete that work. Babylon continued to decline over the next several centuries. Around 24 AD, the Nabataean city of Palmyra was established a trading colony that was abandoned no later than 75 AD. And two Roman emperors traveled to Babylon within the next 100 years of that, and they found it completely uninhabited and nothing but ruins. And so there was always a curse associated with it after that. And it all goes back to some promises God made all the way back in Isaiah, almost 1,000 years before that, where in the book of Isaiah, God said it would be a dwelling place of wild beasts and owls, and even the Arabians would be scared to pitch their tents there. Now, the city would continue to be inhabited for hundreds of years after that and was actually an important city for a good part of that time. But God had already promised, had already pronounced its doom. And when God pronounces something, it's as good as done in His mind, so it doesn't really matter if it takes 1,000 years. A day is unto 1,000 years as 1,000 years is unto a day with the Lord. So no matter what men tried to do, no matter how many times men tried to rebuild this city, they always failed, and it always continued to fall more and more into ruin, until eventually it was literally covered up by the desert and had to be rediscovered. And famously, about 20 or 30 years ago, a dictator in the Middle East promised to rebuild Babylon. Did he succeed? No. And like every other king, general, whatever, in history who tried to rebuild Babylon, he died shortly after making that promise. I'm not going to say the U.S. is God's arm of righteousness in the world today, but God has used nations to punish other nations, and He's used nations to punish one man in particular, oftentimes a king. In this case, it may have been that gentleman who promised to rebuild this city. And that is really the story of Babylon in a nutshell. And Nebuchadnezzar's sins and looking at what he had done can be anybody's sin. Anybody can look at what they've done and say, look what I have done by the might of my power and for my own majesty. That's just human nature. And I actually kind of sympathize with Nebuchadnezzar because I don't know what I would do if I were in his position. But at the time when Babylon was first starting to really accrue power unto itself, at least in the historical period, Abraham was wandering around in tents in a land that God had promised him. And the reason he was content, the book of Hebrews says to do that, is because he was looking for a city that was not on earth. A city that has foundations, which means, to me anyway, that God had already promised it. And a promise from God is as good as done. So he's willing to live as a vagabond because he looked for a city that has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Cain built a city to glorify himself, to protect himself. God's going to is preparing us a city that is a glory to him. And when you look at Babel from Genesis chapter 11 all the way through Revelation, it represents rebellion against God. Man trying to glorify himself. And when man starts to glorify himself, he tends to worship himself. And that's exactly what Nebuchadnezzar would do, worshiping the creature rather than the creator. God's city is designed for us to look at God and worship him. Man's cities tend to be to worship himself. And that's really the key difference that I can see. I hope this was somewhat beneficial to you. Hope it was interesting enough. What we'd like to do at this time is extend an invitation to you. If you'd like to share something with the congregation or ask for help in any way, this congregation is more than happy to do so. Please come forward as we stand and sing.